think it's just important for journalists in Denmark because it's so easy to. I see it with fellow entrepreneurs where like they like to write these articles about entrepreneurs saying this is not very successful because they had a big loss last year. Okay, but they grew from 20 million in revenue to 100 million, and we just had like one of our best years.
Yeah,
honestly, it was like it was like one of the best years we've had. Mm-hmm. This is a big improvement.
So welcome to our second episode of Funded by Plus Impact. We're live from the Blocktop recording studio. And today we're joined by Mads Fibier of Organic Basics and one of their key investors, Daniel Nymark Myers, managing partner in Bumble Ventures. First of all, thank you so much for wanting to sit down with us. Actually, Mads and Daniel, can you maybe quickly introduce yourself and what's your relationship?
For sure. I go first, maybe.
Yes.
I'm Daniel from Bumble Ventures. Really quick about me, went to school at Copenhagen Business School, did finance there, was finished in 2010, went out to PricewaterhouseCoopers and did mergers and acquisitions for 4 years and learned that toolbox and that world and also got to a point where I knew that I wouldn't want to be in that world forever. Albeit a great experience, but not for me for the rest of my life. And around late 2013, I got the brilliant idea to start a tech startup with two other guys. And we raised some money and executed on that in 14, 15, and part of 16. And that was a great experience. It was a very tough experience. It was probably, hopefully, the toughest experience of my life. And we didn't succeed in the way that Mess and his co-founders did. So we ended up making the hard decision to close it down in the middle of 16 there. And after that, I had to find some way to make myself useful again. And that was just, I think, sort of natural for me at least to try to stay on the scene, but be on the other side of the table, at least for a meaningful amount of time, piece my life back together and that kind of thing. And yeah, so since 16, been doing Bumble Ventures with my two partners, Jesper and Christian, and we invested off our own balance sheet until basically September last year, where we made a fund. Okay. So until then, we were just investing our own money, but now we made a fund, $30 million, closed it last year, where we now also have other people investing. So we also handle other people's money now. And yeah, so
super exciting.
Yes. That's amazing news, closing a big fund like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the Danish context, we're very proud of it, and it is a big, but of course, very small compared to some of the big US funds, right? But it's a good place to start, I think.
And you, Mads?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about who you are?
Yeah, so my name is Mads. I'm the co-CEO of Organic Basics. So we started Organic Basics back in 2015 in Aarhus. I started it along with my co-founders, Christopher and Alex. We all knew each other since we were quite young. But basically, back in 2015, that was before anyone really started to talk about sustainability in the fashion industry. And when we started the company, we had this feeling that the fashion industry is the second most polluting industry in the world, and it seemed a bit weird because it was fashion, it wasn't medicine, it wasn't like education or something that's actually quite important, right? So so we felt that wasn't right, and we wanted to make a change in that, and I think the purpose has sort of like grown over the years, and the more you learn about it, and also just with the fact that it's becoming more something that people care about, and it also empower us to do even more in that direction. But yeah, we started back in 2015, and we were very inexperienced. So we launched on Kickstarter, which was back then was all the fuss, and it was like very popular. Around that time, Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club was one of the major startups in the US, and one of my co-founders, Alexander, he had spent some time in San Francisco, so we were obviously very inspired by that entire scene. So we actually launched a men's boxer subscription service as our initial product.
Yeah. So that was part of the Kickstarter?
That was a Kickstarter back then. We got funded within 48 hours, and it was a big success for us. I only think we raised 100,000 was in Danish or a bit more, but for us that was a lot back then. It was enough to get the first production and so on.
Wasn't it the biggest Kickstarter campaign back in the days, or
so
one of the
we've actually done three Kickstarter campaigns, right. Because for us it was, that was before any investors had any interest in us, and it was a great way to raise both awareness and fundraise as well. So we did three Kickstarters. One of them became one of the biggest in the Nordics, but not the first one.
All right.
Okay.
So you learned by doing, basically.
Yeah, that was pretty much trial and error. There was not much of a blueprint back then for how to do it.
Yeah, but also, like, if you scroll through Kickstarter campaigns today, like, you can find, you know, everything, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, what can you trust? What can you not? Like, how do you execute that funding strategy? I mean, and how did you even, like, get into... that, did you have anyone who could help you out setting up your Kickstarter campaigns?
We actually didn't, but from the beginning, the founding team, we also had a fourth partner back then, but the founding team was sort of, we were good in our own areas, so we actually had the internal competencies to sort of like set that up, and we found a good blueprint in a way to like to sort of like replicate what we did the first time, and that gave us a lot of initial traction, especially in the US, because it's mostly US based, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then in 2017, at that time we were actually living in San Francisco, all the founders, we moved there because we had this probably very naive idea that, okay, San Francisco, Silicon Valley, that's where all the big startups come from, so that's where we need to be as well. And also we had a lot of US traction with the Kickstarter, so we went over there and we lived in it's a very classic startup story actually, right? Because we lived in the same house, we had our office right outside our bedrooms and so on, and we stayed over there for a full year, which was actually also at that point we met Daniel, and where we raised our first round of investments, which again at that point was a huge deal for us, and we thought we with that money we would have enough to do everything and so on. And and then we went back to Denmark in 2018 after we raised this investment, and we established an office at Vesterbro in a small apartment there, and sort of built the team from there. Now we reside in Amager. We're about 45 people.
Right.
And the change or the focus has changed quite a bit since we did men's boxer shorts on a subscription. Mm-hmm. Now we focus more on actually producing the most sustainable garments we can. We focus actually more on women than we do on men, because for some reason we learned they care more about their underwear than men do, which was probably not a big surprise to a lot of people. We also learned that many women are sort of like further in their head when it comes to sustainability and organic qualities and so on. So we sort of, I think what they call in Silicon Valley, they would say we pivoted from this initial product.
And what's so special about this underwear? You have a special material or fabric, right?
Yes. So when we, that's actually also going quite a bit back, but in 2017, when we did this big Kickstarter campaign, we used something called SilverTech, or we trademarked it SilverTech. So it's antibacterial technology that will sort of make the clothing last longer in many ways, especially because it's antibacterial and therefore you don't have to wash that often. And that's sort of like how you, one thing, ruin your clothing, but it's also a big environmental impact with all the washing that you do. It's 40% of the effect of a piece of clothing. So that was a big thing for us. But I think what we then learned was that was sort of like the functionality aspect of sustainability, which we really cared a lot about at that point. But we realized that there are like many different and less sort of technical ways where you can have a much bigger impact. We also learned that especially the female demographic, they didn't respond too well to not having to wash their underwear. like it didn't sell too well. So for what we're working more with now and a material we like much more is Tencel, which is a closed loop fiber, originally developed in Austria, I believe. But it's sort of, so what we did previously, we mixed organic cotton with this Silvertech fabric, and organic cotton is much better than regular cotton, but it's not going to save the world in any way. But Tencel, on the other hand, is something that works much more, and that's what we sell the most of now. So we're always trying to steer the customer demand towards the more sustainable product.
That's also a good starting point. You actually mentioned that you met Daniel. Was that back in...
That was in 2017.
Was that when you were still in San Francisco?
Yes.
All right. So how did that even come about? Like, how did you connect?
So we were raising money almost as soon as we got over there because it's very expensive to be there. I think even though we lived a lot of people in one house, I think the rent was like... 50,000 Danish or something like that. It's incredibly expensive. It's also expensive just to live there and salaries if you want to hire people and so on. So we started our fundraising journey back then. And I think as when you try to raise money the first time, you're going to make a lot of mistakes and you're going to like approach it. Or at least we're approaching it differently than we did back then now. But what sort of happened was that we started reaching out to a lot of investors, and actually one of my old school friends had worked in the company that sort of created Daniel's VC fund, and that was sort of like the entry. So I had my old friend forward our pitch deck to Daniel, and then
We didn't actually meet in San Francisco. I was actually living in London. What was his name?
Anas.
He was working. So Anas was working at Better Collective, which is my two partners, Jesper and Christian. Their daytime jobs is to be the CEO and COO of a big company called Better Collective. And Anas was working there, I guess, and got the deck. And then Jesper... came running and said, "We have to look at this." And then I had a lot of other stuff to do, so I said, "No, yes, we have to look at this."
But back in actually in 2017, I read in your case study about your relationship that you weren't so sure about the business actually, but that you really had this strong belief about the team. How do you feel about the business now?
Better. I mean, but this is not super specific to Organic Basics. This is just I mean, you were really young at that point in time, right? You were, and everyone is when they're raising their pre-seed round. It's just you know, it's at a certain point, there's not really so much data else you can build your conviction on, right? So this is not specific to Organic Basics. It's just sort of a stage thing, right? Where at one point you have to say, okay, well, is there demand? Yes, there is. Okay. Well, you know, can they scale it a little bit? Yes, they can. But do you know anything about the unit economics? No, you really don't. Right? So how does this look at scale? I think for a pre-seed case, that's where you do have to have that team conviction. That's the missing piece. Otherwise you can't really make the decision. So it was important.
And have they lived up to your expectations?
Yeah. They exceeded them, I think. Because, I mean, we couldn't imagine what it is now at that point in time. Yeah. Maybe you couldn't even, I don't know. But it's been very good to be an investor so far.
Yes. Were you a part of changing their strategy from going from selling boxes and subscription more towards... a broader product portfolio?
No, I don't think we would have played a big role in that. You and I have always talked about data, but I think all those specific discussions there, you guys always...
I think indirectly you probably were, right? Because Daniel was very good in the beginning to sort of like sanity check the way we approached our expectations and forecasts and like, okay, we can just scale this by just adding more and then we'll just go directly like this and blah, blah, blah. And sort of like he sort of like sanity checked a lot of the metrics we're using and the way that we were, the data we used to make decisions in the end, right? And all of a sudden it became painfully clear that we needed to change direction. But honestly, it wasn't one of those cases where you're looking and see, okay, we have this product that is not working. What actually happened for us was that just a lot of women started approaching us, asking us to make women's underwear. Mm. And we were a men's underwear company. And we thought it was a bit special because as men, we wouldn't approach Victoria's Secret and ask them to do men's underwear.
No,
right?
No, so of course not.
There must be some connection. Maybe women actually really want organic underwear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we played around with this hypothesis and we just launched initial women's products. And within a very, very short time, we sold more towards women than we did to men. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that sort of like situation where you go back to the drawing board and you want to try something completely new. It just happened more organically.
It was the demand knocking on your door.
Exactly.
But you had quite a close relationship the whole time. Like you were like the sanity check, like you were telling Daniel was doing.
Yeah.
Was there anything else? Like how did the relationship look like actually on a regular basis? Were you checking in regularly?
Honestly, I think Daniel were more involved than he wanted to be in the very beginning because after we raised our first investment round, which was Daniel and a few other investors, we quickly realized that the expectations that we had set towards these investors in the beginning, it would become very, very difficult for us to meet that. And we were running out of cash much quicker than we expected. And so Daniel and I sort of like sat down and we started really to try and understand how can we sort of like predict the cash flows? How can we make changes to this? How can we sort of like turn this like money burning business into something that can actually become profitable in time, right? So I think that's the big value add we saw from Bumble Ventures. And Daniel has also always been sort of like in a pre-seed round, often they will choose one person that will be the lead, not necessarily the investment lead, but the lead towards the company and the one that has the most touch points. And that's always been Daniel.
Mm.
So I would say we've been working closely together.
Yeah. I mean, especially in the best of all days.
A couple
of weekends. It has been great. But there was that hump there in the beginning where we were like, oh shit, wow, there's some metrics that we need to get more firm on and that kind of stuff. And it was tough, but that's where something as simple as like, do you like each other and do you respect each other? I think that helps a lot when you then have to have these like really intense
chemistry periods. I could imagine is super important.
And you invested a second time, right, in Organic Basics. When was it? 2018 or what was it? You had the second round with those
we invested
I think you've maybe done it three times actually.
Last year we wrote another ticket Yeah, it's easier as an investor to do follow-up investments if you are in there sort of together with the founders. I mean, I'm far from a founder in this company, or they I have no idea in such great detail as these guys do what happens. But there is that open line of communication always, and there is that, at least me and Mass, we're with a sort of number of people here, so we speak exactly the same language. So.
Mm.
You know, the thing with Organic Basics is that it's so visionary and you guys want to do so much. And you helped me build that bridge down to, well, what does that mean for the numbers? So it's just to say that it's as long as you're close to the company, it makes it easier to make decisions like that. Then,
Because we read, when we were researching a little bit, we read in Finance that you had carried this international expansion strategy which had accumulated quite a big, I don't know if it's so substantial, but deficit of 10 million kroner. And how, as an investor, does it feel? Or why did you invest a second or third time in them despite this? Is it part of the deal? Or?
I don't even know what to say about it. I mean, that article is, I don't know if I, but I mean, we're venture investors, right? We ask them to run those deficits, right? I mean, it's I mean the whole model is to say, does the unit economics work, right? If you buy a customer, does that customer bring in more revenue and gross profit and significantly more than it costs to buy it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we scale that up. And for a while, that will, for a while, there just won't be enough volume to cover the cost base. So it's just like, this is just simple math. You can make an article about that, but I don't get the newsworthiness. But
no, I hated that article. I really,
it's so silly.
Yeah.
But I think it's good to hear also your take on it because it's about your relationship.
Honestly, it's worse having FSC. These so-called business journalists trying to write articles. I don't want to sound mad about this, I think it's just important for journalists in Denmark because it's so easy to. I see it with fellow entrepreneurs where like they like to write these articles about entrepreneurs saying, okay, so they had this is not very successful because they had a big loss last year. Okay, but they grew from 20 million in revenue to 100 million.
Yeah, exactly.
And they lost 5 million this year. Last year, they lost 20. Mm-hmm. This is a big improvement, but you're still going to frame it like that, right?
Yeah.
And I don't care too much because VCs or investors, which is the ones in the end that we sort of like, if you're fundraising, at least you care about how they look at the company. They know this game, but your average business journalist might not know this game. In their world, it's all about if you don't have profits the first year, then it's not successful. That's not how venture works, right?
No.
I mean, it's obviously totally the right to write an article like that. But there is a recklessness to it, maybe a little bit, because your employees read that and they're like, ah, don't we have any money?
Yeah, exactly.
But
are we fired?
No, because I remember like when that specific article came, we just had like one of our best years.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was like one of the best years we've had, and like we'd grown quite a lot, and our loss had become like much smaller. It was just like totally on the right trajectory, like all according to the plan, all performing in terms of like our budgets and everything.
Yeah.
And then that's came, right?
You have to keep your inner balance and not be thrown off by stuff like this.
It's difficult to maneuver in because I didn't want to. I remember commenting on that article. I didn't want to give any comments because I knew the angle he wanted to take, and he was like, okay, either you comment or I'll just write it myself.
Yeah.
Like, I'm trapped in this.
But you got another investment anyway, and you're still on track, right? So that's the most important thing.
No, and I think now Organic Basics has also gotten to sort of like the stage where I'm still very reliant on Daniel's advice and so on, but we're not that, we don't require funds the same way. We're not, we're actually profitable this year. So we are in a different stage. And
congrats on that, by the way.
Yeah, thanks. it changes a lot in these dynamics, and it changes the way that you work in a way, because you're not constantly trying to make yourself seem attractive in the media or whatever. I don't think we've done any media articles for quite a long time because it's not the focus right now. It gives a lot of breathing room that you know that you don't need to raise a new round in the next 6 months or 12 months or whatever.
Yeah. Bumble Ventures' mission is that they want to prepare like your portfolio startups to set them up for like the best possible Series A round. So Mads, do you feel like that Bumble Ventures and Daniel have actually provided you with that set of tools?
I really do, but I'm also, so it comes with the story that we are three co-founders, all with different skills, and I'm on the data number side, so is Daniel, so we really speak the same language, right?
Yeah, you speak to the right couple of people.
We actually discussed this yesterday as well, but the bigger you get, the more important predictability becomes, right? Because it's going to hurt that much more if you're not predicting right in terms of your cash flow, or cash flow is the most important one, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise you can't exist. And I think with the bigger investors become, the my experience at least is that then they want to evaluate the company for a longer period of time. So you can't just show them a point in time and say, right now we're doing super well. They will meet you and you tell them you're doing well and they will evaluate for the next 3-6 months, something right. like that, right? And then you need to be able to show them, you tell them in the initial call, you tell them this is what we're going to do within the next 6 months, and then they're going to evaluate and see whether that's the case, right? So you need to be able to actually have some sort of idea where you're going financially. So both on a revenue level and cost and cash flow level. So I think it's important. The bigger you get, the less room you have for error there, because they're not going to trust you. If you say, hey, we're going to do 30 million within the next 6 months and you do 10, then I think the financial predictability is, in my world, very, very, very important.
Yeah. We back to when you even started fundraising. We actually, I don't know if you know Jess Fleischer from Son of a Tailor.
Yeah, I've spoken to him.
Yeah, also sustainable fashion brand. We had him on our first episode, actually.
Yeah.
And we asked him whether being an impact startup, as we like to define the business, if it ever affected his fundraising journey, actually. And he responded that he actually never sold his idea as being an impact startup, because for his point of view, the investors would always focus on the profits. Is that something that you experienced?
So I don't, profits, no, revenue, yes, I would say. I think it's a bit different, because I think we, early on, we might have managed to get a few angel investors because they like the team and they like the idea from the standpoint that they thought, yeah, the world needs this, so that's a good idea. And I think to some degree we do get it. We also, the latest investment we got from a French VC fund in 2019, they only invest in companies with a sustainable angle.
All right.
And we also like to go with investors or VCs that share that sort of vision, because then we speak the same language and they're not gonna, because often sustainability will be a profit trade-off. You can be more profitable if you do some things in a not sustainable way, and you don't want to have that next board meeting where that becomes a point of discussion that you shouldn't take the sustainable choice because it's going to be more costly, right? So you need to make sure that you're completely aligned. So I would always prefer to work with investors that have that same mindset.
This is super good advice.
Yeah.
Did it ever change your perspective, Daniel? I'm thinking that you are not specifically impact oriented at Bumble Ventures. Looking forward, has this journey opened your eyes to sustainable brands?
Yeah, I think that's the right way to say it, that this journey has opened my eyes. I mean, I started doing this back in 2016, and we didn't have, okay, well, we have to do it in sustainable avenues and stuff like that. So I've been through an education, I think, with these guys as well, and with sort of coming to the conclusion lately, especially also talking to you guys and Christoph always pushing, that, I mean, a lot of the founder talent is seeking towards impact, right? And they're not saying, okay, we're going to do charity, we're going to say we're going to do great businesses, but great businesses are going to grow in impact going forward. And I think that signal is pretty clearly picked up by a guy like me.
Yeah.
So whether I can have my own personal opinions about the importance of that, but as an investor on behalf of my LPs, I'm forced to take an interest. I think everyone, even if you call yourself a generalist fund, you're forced to take an interest in these huge opportunities there, because I think that's where the founder talent will go. And I think if you spend time together with, you can of course also get to that conclusion from behind your desk, but if you spend time with people who poke you in that direction, it goes faster. So, yeah.
And you have a few other companies in your portfolio that are impact. There's the company Her, I think, in the US is one of them, for example.
From the social angle there, yeah. Right? Yeah. Again, not an investment we made because it was impact. Just because Robin is a kick-ass founder and it's a great company. So, but yeah, we do have. I mean, But those have arrived in the portfolio from the angle of being good business people. I mean, that's how they got in there.
And you don't treat them any different from the other ones, basically.
No, not at all. But those journeys have, of course, then contributed to being more aware that more and more that's just going to be where it is, right? I mean, even if we didn't do anything, our funnel of talent coming into us is just going to be more and more those people. So anyways, it's a way of saying that, I mean, if you spent time around founders and you've spent time around founders for the last couple of years, you will notice a more purpose means something, right, to top talent. So
if an impact startup came to you and asked for funding, would you take them because of their kick-ass team or because of their amazing impact? What should they pitch to you? Well,
I mean, what they should pitch. I mean, they obviously have to be a great team. That's important. But just because the mechanics of doing a startup doesn't really work if it's not great talent. Mm-hmm. With the business potential of solving this problem, right? And that argument could be made in so many ways, right? From the consumer standpoint, you know, anyone who doesn't buy into the idea that people with a lot of money in their pocket more and more care about, vote with their money and are willing to pay a premium for sustainably produced garments, for example, stuff like that. Anyone who doesn't buy into that, I just don't think is a good business person, is investing on behalf of the LPs. So they would just have to make the case that, okay, here's the business case for investing in impact. For Bumble Ventures, they would at least have to do that until we get a mandate just to do charity. But we don't have that mandate yet.
No.
But I just think it's increasingly getting. I'm increasingly getting easier and easier convinced of that business case there, not just in consumer but in B2B as well. Yeah.
Yeah. We have one last question. Do you have one in mind?
Well, actually, I think it's basically been covered. Throughout the whole interview, like how Bumble Ventures actually has changed your business, but it seems like in many ways. But when you started your whole strategy, did you see some specific advantages of, or I don't know, even know if you targeted like VC in contrast to a private investor.
Got it. No, in the beginning, you take what you can get, right?
And we weren't really a VC.
No, they weren't a VC. I think in the beginning...
So you just needed the cash.
then it's about like just catching the first investor so you can tell the other investors that, oh, these guys are on and there's a lot of traction now and everybody's fighting to get in this round and like trying like frame it like that, right? Yeah. But I think as we've grown and learned more about the game, definitely, we've also had one investor that is not an investor anymore because it didn't work.
It didn't, okay.
Or one venture capital fund. So we've learned a lot, and I think we're trusting our intuition way more now because with the one previous partner that didn't work, we felt that from the beginning, but we needed the money. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't that much to do in the end, right? Mm-hmm. But I think I just want to comment on what you said. I think what we've talked about, the partnership between Bumble and Organic Basics, it's been very much, so Daniel has been supporting so much on the financial side, right? Especially towards me. But I think that the more important role they've taken is that they are the ones we call when something is on fire and when it's really going down, right? Because I think it comes more down to like the personal connection. And so, for example, last night, Daniel and I had a meeting. We were out drinking beer and we were talking, right? It's a different investor relationship and it's someone where you trust a lot and we've been through so much shit together, right? Mm-hmm. That I think it's about also really trusting both your investor group but also the people who will then be in your board to sort of like support the founder's vision and not try and come in as an investor or VC and think you know better than the founders do and what they want to do with their vision. It's still their company. You might own a small stake in it, right?
Yeah.
But you need to empower them and support them because you also investors, I assume, wouldn't want any like founders that would just be like, okay, what do you guys think we should do? Because you want someone that like know what they want to do, right?
Yeah.
I concur. I mean, you invest in people who own their own business. It's so easily forgotten, I think, and I feel sometimes it's forgotten because there's this construction, we have called venture capital, where, okay, you come with the money, so, and you come with all this value add, and we're good at, as VCs, at saying we have all this value add, which, I mean, there is also something, but in the fog of all that, it's, I feel like sometimes it gets lost that that's not what, as a VC, you shouldn't invest in, you shouldn't be able to have that big an impact, right? You should invest in people who own and know how to run their own company, and you can provide mm-hmm. some guidance. And that. But that spark that drives everything, that really has to lie with the founders. And so there's this weird, you can add some value, but at the end of the day,
Yeah,
it has to come from you guys. But I think, so, I mean, some VCs may have a harder time than others for that. But
yeah. Nice. I think we're.
Yeah, I think it's all we had.
Yes.
But thank you so much, both of you, super interesting conversation. Also, letting us into your founder and investor relationship.
Yeah. Which is super inspiring. I think a lot of people would like to drink beer with their investors.
Yeah, we only had two, as I was going to say. My girlfriend.
No, but it's lots of learnings from your relationship. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.